Chapter 17. For a man who changed the world, Henry Ford travelled in very small circles. He resided his whole life within a dozen miles of his birthplace, a farm at Dearborn, just outside Detroit. He saw little of the wider world and cared even less for it. He was defiantly narrow-minded, barely educated, and at least close to functionally illiterate. His beliefs were powerful but consistently dubious, and made him seem, in the words of the New Yorker, mildly unbalanced. He did not like bankers, doctors, liquor, tobacco, idleness of any sort, pasteurized milk, Wall Street, overweight people, war, books or reading, J.P. Morgan and Company, capital punishment, tall buildings, college graduates, Roman Catholics, or Jews. Especially, he didn't like Jews. Once he hired a Hebraic scholar to translate the Talmud in a manner designed to make Jewish people appear shifty and avaricious. His ignorance was a frequent source of wonder. He believed that the earth could not support the weight placed on it by skyscrapers, and that eventually cities would collapse in on themselves, as in some kind of biblical apocalypse. Engineers explained to him that a large skyscraper typically weighed about 60,000 tons, while the rock and earth excavated for the foundations would weigh more like 100,000 tons, so that skyscrapers actually reduced the burden on the earth beneath them. But Ford was unpersuaded. He seldom let facts or logic challenge the certainty of his instincts. The limits of his knowledge were most memorably exposed in 1919, when he sued the Chicago Tribune for libel for calling him an ignorant idealist and an anarchist. For 8 days, lawyers for the Tribune entertained the nation by punting through the shallow waters of Ford's mind. Asked to identify the notorious traitor Benedict Arnold, Ford replied, "I have heard the name." "Who was he?" pressed the lawyer. "I have forgotten just who he is," Ford answered. "He is a writer, I think." Ford, it transpired, did not know much of anything. He could not say when the American Revolution was fought. "In 1812, I think, I'm not quite sure. Or quite what the issues were that provoked it." Questioned about politics, he conceded that he didn't follow matters closely and had voted only once in his life. That was just after his 21st birthday, when, he said, he had voted for James Garfield. An alert lawyer pointed out that Garfield was in fact assassinated 3 years before Ford reached voting age. And so it went on, day after day. The world was so delighted and enthralled with Ford's ignorance that one enterprising man sold hastily printed copies of Ford's testimony for 25 cents each day outside the courthouse, and bought a house with the profits. Eventually the jury found in Ford's favor, but the jurors, 12 stolid Michigan farmers, who clearly believed they had better things to do with their time, awarded him damages of just 6 cents. The Tribune never paid. Whether Ford was stupid or just inattentive has fueled debate among historians and other commentators for nearly a century. John Kenneth Galbraith had no doubt about the matter. Ford's life and career, he maintained, were marked by obtuseness and stupidity, and, in consequence, by congeries of terrible errors. Alan Nevins and Frank Ernest Hill, in a generally sympathetic biography of 1957, called him an ignoramus outside his chosen field, but an ignoramus of sense and integrity. That was about as warm a tribute as Henry Ford received from those who knew him well or considered him carefully. He was not, in short, a terribly bright or reflective human being. Yet against this must be set his extraordinary achievement. When Henry Ford built his first Model T, Americans had some 2,200 makes of cars to choose from. Every one of those cars was in some sense a toy, a plaything for the well-to-do. Ford changed the automobile into a universal appliance, an affordable device practical for all, and that difference in philosophy made him unimaginably successful and changed the world. Within just over a decade, Ford had more than 50 factories on 6 continents, employed 200,000 people, produced half the world's cars, and was the most successful industrialist in history, worth perhaps as much as $2 billion by one estimate. By perfecting mass production and making the automobile an object within financial reach of the average working man, he wholly transformed the course and rhythm of modern life. We live in a world largely shaped by Henry Ford. But in the summer of 1927, Henry Ford's part of that world was beginning to look a little rocky. Henry Ford was born in July 1863, the same month as the Battle of Gettysburg, and lived into the atomic age, dying in 1948, just short of his 84th birthday. His earliest conviction was that he didn't want to be a farmer, for there was too much work on the place. For the first half of his long life, he was little more than an accomplished mechanic. After leaving school at 16, he worked in various machine and engine shops in Detroit, eventually becoming chief engineer of the Edison Illuminating Company. In the 1890s, he quit that to pursue a fixation with building the best possible motor car. According to Maurice Markey, writing in The New Yorker, Ford was at a car race one day when a French driver crashed and was mortally injured. While others rushed to the stricken driver, Ford rushed to the car, which had survived better than he thought possible. Taking a hunk of chassis away with him, he discovered it was made of vanadium steel, a strong but lightweight material. Vanadium steel became the foundation metal for every car he made henceforth. However true or not that story, it is certainly the case that Ford didn't rush into production until he'd worked out every detail of production and composition. He was 40 years old before he founded the Ford Motor Company in 1903, and 45 when he produced his first Model T 5 years later. Footnote: the Model T was preceded by 8 other models. The models A, B, C, F, N, R, S, and K, in that order. If there was a logic to that sequence, Ford failed to explain it in his memoir, My Life and Work. The Model T, like Ford himself, was an unlikely candidate for greatness. It was almost willfully rudimentary. For years, the car had no speedometer and no fuel gauge. Drivers who wanted to know how much gas they had in the tank had to stop the car, get out, and tip back the driver's seat to check a dipstick located on the chassis floor. Determining the oil level was even trickier. The owner, or some other compliant soul, had to slide under the chassis, open 2 petcocks with pliers, and judge from how fast the oil ran out how much and how urgently more was needed. For gears, the car employed something called a planetary transmission, which was famously idiosyncratic. It took much practice to master the 2 forward gears and 1 reverse gear. The headlights, run off a magneto, were uselessly dim at low speeds and burned so hot at high speeds that they were inclined to explode. The front and rear tires were of different sizes, a needless quirk that required every owner to carry 2 sets of spares. Electric starters didn't become standard until 1926, years after nearly all other manufacturers included them as a matter of routine. Yet the Model T inspired great affection. It was a source of many loving jokes. In one, a farmer whose tin house roof had been mangled in a tornado sent it to the Ford factory, hoping they could advise him how to restore it. The message came back, "Your car is one of the worst wrecks we have ever seen, but we should be able to fix it." For all its faults, the Model T was practically indestructible, easily repaired, strong enough to pull itself through mud and snow, and built high enough to clear ruts at a time when most rural roads were unpaved. It was also admirably adaptable. Many farmers modified their Model Ts to plow fields, saw lumber, pump water, bore holes, or otherwise perform useful tasks. One central characteristic of the Model T that is now generally forgotten is that it was the first car of consequence to put the driver's seat on the left-hand side. Previously, nearly all manufacturers placed the driver on the outer curb side of the car, so that an alighting driver could step out onto a grassy verge or dry sidewalk, rather than into the mud of an unpaved road. Ford reasoned that this convenience might be better appreciated by the lady of the house, and so arranged seating for her benefit. The arrangement also gave the driver a better view down the road, and made it easier for passing drivers to stop and have a conversation out of facing windows. Ford was no great thinker, but he did understand human nature. Such, in any case, was the popularity of Ford's seating plan for the Model T that it soon became the standard adopted by all cars. The Model T was an immediate success. In its first full year, Ford produced 10,607 cars, more than any manufacturer had ever made before, and still couldn't meet demand. Production doubled annually, more or less, until by 1913-14, it was producing nearly 250,000 cars a year, and by 1920-21, over 1,250,000. The most persistent belief about the Model T, that you could have it in any color so long as it was black, was only ever partly true. Early versions of the car came in a small range of colors, but the colors depended on which model one bought. Runabouts were gray, touring cars red, and town cars green. Black, notably, was not available at all. It became the exclusive color in 1914 simply because black enamel was the only color that would dry fast enough to suit Henry Ford's assembly line methods. And that lasted only until 1924, when blue, green, and red were made available. One thing above all accounted for Ford's competitive edge, the moving assembly line. The process was perfected bit by bit between 1906 and 1914, not so much as a progressive, systematic plan, but more as a series of desperate expedients to try to keep up with demand. The basic idea of the assembly line, or progressive assembling as it was at first known, came from the movement of animal carcasses through the slaughterhouses of Chicago, which, as has often been noted, was actually a kind of disassembly line. Other companies used assembly line techniques. It was how Westinghouse made air brakes. But no other manufacturer embraced the system as comprehensively and obsessively as Ford. Workers in Ford plants were not permitted to talk, hum, whistle, sit, lean, pause for reflection, or otherwise behave in a non-robotic fashion while working, and were given just one 30-minute break per shift in which to go to the lavatory, have lunch, or attend to any other personal needs. Everything was arranged for the benefit of the production line. Henry Ford was always happy to take credit for the invention of the assembly line process, but it seems he may have been generous to himself. Henry Ford had no ideas on mass production, Ford's colleague Charles Sorensen once recalled. Far from it, he just grew into it like the rest of us. Thanks to the slickness of operations, the time it took to produce a Ford car fell from 12 hours in 1908, which was already good going, to just an hour and a half after 1913, when the company's Highland Park factory opened. At the peak of production, a new car, truck, or tractor rolled off a Ford assembly line somewhere in America every 10 seconds. By 1913, the company had sales of nearly $100 million and profits of $27 million. With the greater efficiencies, the cost of a Model T fell too, from $850 in 1908 to $500 in 1913, and down to $390 in 1914, before finally settling at an almost preposterously reasonable $260 by 1927. In 1914, Ford introduced an 8-hour day, 40-hour week, and doubled average salaries to $5 a day in what is often presented as an act of revolutionary magnanimity. In fact, it was necessitated by the costly waste of high employee turnover, a breathtaking 370% in 1913. At the same time, Ford established its notorious sociological department, employing some 200 investigators who were empowered to look into every aspect of employees' private lives, their diet, hygiene, religion, personal finances, recreational habits, and morals. Ford's workforce was full of immigrants. In some periods, as many as 2/3 of his employees were from abroad, and Ford genuinely wished to help them live healthier, more satisfying lives. So his sociological meddling was by no means entirely a bad thing. However, there was almost nothing Henry Ford did that didn't have some bad in it somewhere, and the sociological department certainly had a totalitarian tinge. Ford employees could be ordered to clean their houses, tidy their yards, sleep in American-style beds, increase their savings, modify their sexual behavior, and otherwise abandon any practice that a Ford inspector deemed derogatory to good physical manhood or moral character. Foreign-born workers who wished to advance within the company were required to take citizenship and language classes. Ford also, it must be said, employed a great many disabled people, including, in 1919, one man who had no hands, four who had no legs or feet, four who were blind, 37 who were deaf, and 60 who had epilepsy, at a time when epileptics were scorned. He also employed between 400 and 600 ex-convicts. Ford also hired black men, though he nearly always gave them the hottest, dirtiest, and most exhausting jobs. Black women, in 1927, were never hired. Who deserves the credit for Ford's success has been a matter of dispute since that success began. Many have suggested that the real brains of the operation was James Cousins, Ford's Canadian-born partner. Cousins had started his working life as a clerk in a coal yard, but joined Ford early on and showed an extraordinary flair for business. Cousins set up and managed Ford's finances, sales, distribution network, and advertising. Henry Ford attended almost exclusively to production. By this view, Henry Ford gave the company a name and an ethos, but Cousins made it a global colossus. Ford and Cousins constantly squabbled, sometimes bitterly, and success only made matters worse. Ford began to resent Cousins' $150,000-a-year salary, particularly after he worked out that it added 50 cents to the cost of every car they built. He didn't think Cousins was worth it, and essentially drove him to leave. Cousins sold out in 1915 and went into politics, eventually becoming a U.S. senator for Michigan, where he made himself famous by attacking Andrew Mellon for favoring the rich, an irony appreciated by many since Cousins was believed to be the richest man in Congress. Cousins' departure was a source of immediate worry for many. There was something of a feeling that while Ford was a great mechanic, he wasn't much of a businessman, a Ford insider named E.G. Pip wrote in 1926, and there were fears of what would happen to the company if Cousins left. What happened, in fact, isn't certain. Without Cousins, Ford carried on much as before. Though it did go into a gradual decline, it is impossible to say to what extent that was a reflection of Cousins' departure. What can be said is that all the real innovations at Ford happened when Cousins was there, and none of lasting consequence happened after, at least not until the summer of 1927, and those were by no means unalloyed successes. By the late 1920s, one American in six owned a car, which was getting close to a rate of one per family, and many people were finding the automobile an essential part of life. The sociologists Robert and Helen Lind, in their classic study of Middle America, Middle Town, published in 1929, found to their surprise that people in the anonymous town of the title, which in fact was Muncie, Indiana, had more cars than bathtubs. Asked why, one woman replied simply, "Because we can't go to town in a bathtub." Unfortunately, and increasingly, the cars Americans loved were not Fords. Other makers were producing cars of superior quality and value. General Motors supplied as standard such devices as speedometers and shock absorbers that Ford was slow to supply at all. GM, moreover, produced a range of cars to fit every pocket, from Chevrolets at the basic end to Cadillacs at the top. Cadillac was such an exclusive division that it maintained a showroom in Manhattan where, as its ads boasted, sales are neither made nor discussed. Visitors could admiringly inspect the latest models, but had to go elsewhere for the sordid business of making a purchase. Under the enterprising leadership of Alfred Sloan, Jr., General Motors constantly restyled and refined its cars, adding new colors and features to stimulate interest and excitement. By the late 1920s, GM was well on its way to perfecting the annual model change, a practice that was essentially needless but magnificently effective as a marketing tool. Also racing up from behind was the new Chrysler Corporation, which was formed out of the old Maxwell Motor Company and named after Walter Chrysler, its dynamic head. By the late 1920s, Chrysler was doing so extraordinarily well that he could afford to build a magnificent monument to himself. The result was the fabled 77-story Chrysler building, which, upon completion, was the world's tallest building. Not for long, however. 11 months later, it was superseded by the Empire State Building. All this combined to make Ford look increasingly old-fashioned and flat-footed. Ford's last really good year was 1923. Between then and the end of 1926, total production at the company went down by 400,000. During the same period, production went up by an almost equal amount at Chevrolet, a division that had been developed by William Knudsen, a brilliant former Ford engineer who had been driven into the arms of General Motors by Henry's autocratic methods. Remarkably, while this was happening, Henry Ford increasingly occupied himself with other, less urgent matters. He pursued a fixation with finding industrial uses for agricultural products. He was particularly taken with what he saw as the infinite adaptability of the soybean. He wore suits woven from soy fibers and built experimental cars made almost exclusively with soy plastics and other materials. The car never went into production because it could never be made not to stink. He fed guests dinners that consisted primarily of soybean products. Pineapple rings with soybean cheese, soybean bread with soybean butter, apple pie with soy crust, roasted soybean coffee, and soy milk ice cream, in the words of his biographer, Greg Grandin. Ford so admired the head of his soybean research division, Edsel Ruderman, that he named his only child after him. To promote his personal beliefs, he bought a dying weekly newspaper, the Dearborn Independent, and turned it into a general interest magazine. The Independent became famous for the dullness of its features and the waywardness of its views. It was produced from some surplus factory space, prompting one wag to call it the best weekly ever turned out by a tractor plant. Ford interfered with it extensively. One of his ideas was to bring assembly line methods to its production. Instead of assigning each article to an individual writer, as on a conventional publication, he wanted the articles to proceed along a kind of editorial assembly line, where a team of specialists would each make a specific contribution and then pass the article on. One writer would supply the facts, another the humor, a third the moral instruction, and so on. Ford was persuaded to drop that idea, but tinkered enough in other areas to ensure that the Independent was always terrible. He lost hundreds of thousands of dollars a year on the magazine, and would have lost still more had he not forced his dealers to take copies to sell on to their customers. Though it was a rare customer who was eager to read long articles like Famous Frenchman I Have Met by A.M. Somerville Story, a writer about as obscure then as now, or The American Merchant Marine Must Be Built by Business Enterprise and Not by Government Subsidy by W.C. Cowling, a Ford executive. Regularly, and more notoriously, the Independent ran strident attacks on the world's Jews. It accused them of manipulating stock markets, working for the overthrow of Christianity, using Hollywood as a propaganda tool for Jewish interests, promoting jazz, moron music as the Independent called it, to the masses for nefarious purposes, encouraging the wearing of short skirts and rolled stockings, and fixing the 1919 World Series, among much else. Accuracy was not its strong suit. In a 1921 article entitled How Jews Degraded Baseball, it pilloried Harry Frazee of the Red Sox on the assumption that he was a Jew. In fact, Frazee was a Presbyterian. The bulk of these essays were gathered together in a volume called The International Jew, which was greatly admired in Nazi Germany, where it was reprinted no fewer than 29 times. Henry Ford had the additional distinction of being the only American mentioned favorably in Mein Kampf, Adolf Hitler's memoir of 1925. Hitler, it was said, kept a framed photo of Ford on his wall. Ford's anti-Semitism seems to have been of a type peculiarly his own. For one thing, it appears not to have been personal. So far as can be told, he had nothing against Jews as individuals. He happily put the design of his factories in the hands of Albert Kahn, a Jewish emigre, with whom he had a good relationship for 35 years. When Rabbi Leo Franklin, an old friend and neighbor, broke with Ford over some of the accusations contained in the Independent, Ford was genuinely mystified. "What's wrong, Dr. Franklin?" he inquired sincerely. "Has anything come between us?" Ford's antagonism was instead based on the conviction that a shadowy cabal of Jews was trying to take over the world. The source of these beliefs was a mystery to all. I am sure that if Mr. Ford were put on the witness stand, He could not tell to save his life just when and how he got started against the Jews, remarked Edwin Pip, first editor of The Independent, who soon quit the magazine rather than print the kind of essays Ford wanted. Ironically, it was a personal attack that got Ford in trouble now. In the course of its rantings, The Independent libeled a lawyer named Aaron Sapiro by claiming that he was a member of a band of Jew bankers, lawyers, advertising agencies, and produce buyers who had cheated American farmers as part of a conspiracy to take control of the American wheat market. Sapiro sued for defamation, demanding $1 million in damages. The case would cast a shadow over Ford for much of the first half of 1927. Ford was scheduled to give testimony in the trial on April the 1st, but the day before his appearance he was involved in a strange accident. According to Ford's own account to police, he was driving home from work when two men in a Studebaker forced him from the road. Ford bounced out of control down a steep embankment and crashed into a tree on the bank of the Rouge River. The tree very possibly saved his life, for the river was dangerously swollen from recent heavy rains, the same rains that were causing the Mississippi floods further south. Ford arrived home on foot, dazed and bleeding, with a deep gash over one eye and another serious cut on the top of his head. The two men in the Studebaker were never found. A widespread presumption was that Ford had faked the crash to avoid having to testify the next day, but the severity of his injuries seemed to belie that. An alternative theory was that Ford, who was a notoriously exasperating motorist to be stuck behind, he drove slowly and in the middle of the road, had been overtaken by a frustrated driver and was accidentally bumped off the road or swerved off in startlement. Whatever the cause, the effect was to stop the libel case from proceeding as planned. A new trial was scheduled, but Ford decided not to fight. Instead, after lengthy reflection, he issued a seemingly heartfelt letter apologizing to Sapiro personally and enclosing a check for $140,000 to cover his costs, and to Jews generally, and promised never to attack either again. The letter was dated June 30th, but made public on July 8th. In the letter, Ford claimed that he had been unaware of the terrible things that The Independent had been saying about Jews. Had I appreciated even the general nature, to say nothing of the details, of these utterances, I would have forbidden their circulation without a moment's hesitation, he declared, in language that was patently not his own. I have been greatly shocked as a result of my study of the files of the Dearborn Independent and of the pamphlets entitled The International Jew. All this was a little rich, as many of the charges made against the Jews had been contained in a column signed by Ford, or in interviews that he had given to other publications. Joseph Palmer, a Ford official who was closely involved with drafting the letter of apology, confided afterwards that Henry Ford had never in fact read his own letter and was only loosely acquainted with its contents. At all events, the Independent ceased its vituperative attacks. With the paper's circulation falling, Ford halved the cover price to a nickel, but still no one bought it, so in late 1927 he closed it. In 8 years, it had cost him nearly $5 million. Ford remained true to his word and never publicly criticized Jews again. That isn't to say that he necessarily abandoned his beliefs, however. Just over a decade later, on his 75th birthday, he accepted one of Nazi Germany's highest civilian honors, the Grand Cross of the German Eagle, which came garlanded with praise from Adolf Hitler. Only one other prominent American of the period was so admired and honored by the Nazis, or so openly admired them in return, Charles Lindbergh. But in 1927, all that lay in the future. For now, with the Sapiro affair out of the way, Henry Ford could turn his attention to some other more pressing matters. One was a mad scheme to grow rubber in South America. The other was trying to save his business. Chapter 18. In 1871, a 25-year-old English adventurer named Henry Wickham moved to the steamy far north of Brazil, just below the equator, with his large extended family. Wife, mother, brother, sister, sister's fiancé, brother's fiancé, and brother's fiancé's mother, and two or three other prospective adventurers who signed on as help. This unlikely group settled at Santarém, at the confluence of the Amazon and Tapajós rivers, with high hopes of becoming rich as planters. The experience proved disastrous. Their crops repeatedly failed, and tropical fevers carried off 3 members of the group in the second year, and 2 more in the third. By 1875, only Wickham and his wife remained. The other survivors had gone back to England. In an attempt to salvage something from the experience, Wickham travelled upriver and into the jungle, and laboriously collected 70,000 seeds of the Brazilian rubber tree, Hevea brasiliensis. Rubber was becoming a valued product in the world, and had brought great wealth to Manaus, Para, and other Amazonian ports. Brazil controlled, and jealously guarded, most of the world's output, so Wickham's seed collecting had to be done furtively, and involved a certain measure of personal risk. He brought the seeds back to England and sold them for a good price to the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew. With the money thus made, Wickham went to Queensland in Australia to start a tobacco plantation. That failed. Then he went to Central America, to British Honduras, to grow bananas. That venture failed too. Nothing, if not resilient, Wickham recrossed the Pacific to British New Guinea, now Papua New Guinea, took out a 25-year lease on land in the conflict islands, and set about collecting sponges, cultivating oysters, and producing copra from coconuts. At last he achieved modest success, but the isolation was more than his wife could bear. She decamped to Bermuda and never saw him again. In the meantime, the rubber seeds Wickham had brought back to England were doing spectacularly well. Footnote: Wickham returned to England around 1910 to find himself a national hero. He was given a life annuity by the British Rubber Growers Association and knighted by the King. Kew sent the seeds to several British colonies and found that they thrived in the rich soils and humid conditions of the tropical Far East, did better, in fact, than in their native jungles. In Brazil, Hevea occurred in densities of only 3 or 4 trees per hectare, so workers had to cover lots of ground to tap meaningful supplies of latex. In Singapore, Malaya, and Sumatra, however, Hevea formed luxuriant groves. It had no natural enemies in Asia, so no insects or fungal blights disturbed its growth, and the trees rose majestically to heights of 100 feet. Brazil was hopelessly outclassed. Where once it had a virtual monopoly on the world's high-quality rubber, by the 1920s it produced less than 3%. Roughly 4/5 of all that rubber was consumed in the United States, mostly by the automobile industry. Tires on early cars needed replacing every 2,000 or 3,000 miles on average, so demand was constant and high. In the early 1920s, when reports circulated that Britain intended to introduce a hefty rubber levy as a way of paying off its war debts, America's Commerce Department, under the tireless watch of Herbert Hoover, responded with a crash program to see if there was not some way America could escape its foreign dependence, either by producing its own rubber or inventing a synthetic substitute. Nothing, however, worked. Rubber trees didn't do well anywhere in America, and not even Thomas Edison could come up with an artificial version that would work half as well. Henry Ford took this as a personal challenge. He hated being dependent on suppliers who might raise prices or otherwise take advantage of him, so he always did all in his power to control all the elements of his supply chains. To that end, he owned iron ore and coal mines, forests and lumber mills, the Detroit, Toledo, and Irontown Railroad, and a fleet of ships. When he decided to make his own windshields, he became at a stroke the second largest manufacturer of glass in the world. Ford owned 400,000 acres of forests in Upper Michigan. At the Ford lumber mills, it was the proud boast that they used every bit of the tree but the shade. Bark, sawdust, sap, all were put to commercial use. One Ford product still with us from this process is the Kingsford charcoal briquette. He could not bear the thought of having to stop production because some foreign despot or business cabal was denying him access to some needed product, and by the 1920s he was the single biggest user of rubber on earth. Thus it was in the summer of 1927 that Henry Ford embarked on the most ambitious and ultimately foolish venture of his long life, Fordlandia. His plan was to build a model American community in the jungles of Brazil, and from it run the greatest rubber-producing estate in the world. The Brazilians were so desperate to rejuvenate their moribund rubber industry that they were happy to give Ford almost anything he asked. They sold him 2.5 million acres of rainforest, an area approximately the size of Connecticut, for the knockdown price of $125,000, and excused him for 50 years from paying import duties on materials brought in or export duties on latex sold abroad. He was given permission to build his own airports, schools, banks, hospitals, and private railroads. Essentially, Ford was allowed to set up an autonomous state within Brazil. The company was even given permission to dam the Rio Tapajos if that would make it more comfortable and productive. To supervise and to execute this immense project, Ford dispatched a 37-year-old junior manager named Willis Blakely. Blakely's instructions were precise and vastly beyond his capabilities. He was to build a complete town with a central square, business district, hospital, movie theater, ballroom, golf course, and other useful and fulfilling municipal enterprises. Surrounding this were to be residential neighborhoods of white shingled cottages, each with a neat lawn, flower beds, and vegetable gardens. Artists' illustrations, which the Ford Company helpfully provided, showed a tranquil and idyllic community complete with paved streets and Ford cars, in defiance of the obvious fact that there would be nowhere beyond the very modest confines of the town for them to go. Henry Ford considered almost every detail of the undertaking. The clocks would be set to Michigan time, and prohibition would be observed, even though it was not the law of Brazil. Whatever the cost, Fordlandia would be dedicated to American laws, culture, and values, an outpost of Protestant ideals in the middle of a hot, godless jungle. Beyond and around the town would lie the greatest agricultural operation on the planet. Blakely was not just to plant and nurture forests of towering rubber trees, but also to find industrial uses for all the other fruits of the jungle. Fordlandia would produce paints, fertilizers, medicines, and other useful compounds from the leaves and bark and gummy resins of its dense and prolific plant life. Blakely had no skills or experience that would allow him to achieve any of this. He was little more than an uneducated thug. Long before he got his first sight of the land he was to manage, he was already proving himself an embarrassment to civilized values. Settling temporarily in the port city of Belém, 6 days downriver from the site of Fordlandia, he took a suite overlooking the main plaza in the Hotel Grande. There he horrified the locals by walking around naked and making love to his wife with the shutters open in full view of citizens out for their evening constitutionals. He was frequently drunk, generally boastful, and always obnoxious. He alienated most of the officials who could help him, as well as the business people on whom he would be dependent for supplies. Using American and Brazilian overseers, Blakely hired 3,000 laborers to clear the jungle and build the camp, but little went well once work began. Clearing the jungle was a nightmare. Saw blades designed for the softwood forests of Michigan spun uselessly against iron-hard Brazilian hardwoods. In the dry season, the water level in the Tapajos could fall by as much as 40 feet, and for much of the year it was too shallow for boatloads of equipment to reach the plantation. Such equipment as did arrive frequently proved to be useless, or at least premature. One crate sent from Detroit contained ice-making machines. Another consignment included a narrow-gauge steam locomotive and several hundred feet of track. Blakely failed to build adequate storehouses, so supplies spoiled on the riverbanks. Bags of cement absorbed moisture from the air and became hard as rock. Machines and tools rusted and grew unusable. Anything that was remotely portable was pilfered. Blakely found, moreover, that local growers, fearful of his competition, would not sell him seedlings, so his stock had to be imported from the Far East. Although the seeds he brought in were native to the region, Wickham, as it happened, had collected just across the river from the Ford estate, they struggled to thrive when planted on newly cleared land. Blakely failed to appreciate that Hevea was a jungle tree and needed protection from the scorching sun. It had evolved to grow in isolation, so lacked the resistance needed in crowded conditions. When planted together, the trees became magnets for leafhoppers, caterpillars, red mites, white flies, and other ravenous insects, which overwhelmed the trees with devastating effect. The clearing of great swathes of landscape, also exposed to direct sunlight, streams that had formerly been heavily shaded. Now algae bloomed as never before, causing snail populations to explode. The snails hosted tiny parasitic worms that harbored schistosomiasis, a horrible disease that leaves its victims chronically prostrate with abdominal pain, high fever, fatigue, and diarrhea. Schistosomiasis had been unknown in the region before Ford came along. After Fordlandia, it was endemic. Malaria, yellow fever, elephantiasis, and hookworm were rife as well. Agonizing discomfort could come from almost anywhere. The river teemed with a little fish called candaroo, or toothpick fish, which would swim into any available human orifice, most notoriously the penis, then extend prickly, backward-facing spines, making it impossible to dislodge. On land, maggots from the botfly Dermatobia hominis burrowed into the skin and hatched eggs. Victims knew of an infestation when they could see something wriggling just under their skin, or when sores erupted and newborn maggots spilled out. Beyond the camp boundaries, vipers and jaguars lurked in the undergrowth. The natives were universally hostile. By coincidence, this was the area where the British explorer Percy Fawcett had famously vanished 2 years earlier with his son and another young Englishman while searching for the mythical lost city of Z. Fawcett had developed a theory, more a fixation, really, that a great civilization of pale-skinned people had once existed deep in the rainforests and had left behind a magnificent city that awaited rediscovery. He called the city Z, for no reason that he ever explained. He had no evidence for its existence. He was driven purely by intuition. Fawcett may have been slightly mad, but he was an experienced explorer. He had been making expeditions through Amazonia since 1906, so he knew his way around. That he and his two companions vanished without trace was something of a testament to how tough conditions were in this part of the world. One theory was that Fawcett and his companions had been confused with the members of another party of adventurers led by the American Alexander Hamilton Rice, who had been exploring the same area at about the same time, to Fawcett's extreme irritation. Rice was fabulously rich thanks to marriage to a wealthy widow, Eleanor Widener, who endowed the Widener Library at Harvard. His wife's money allowed Rice to fund enormous expeditions with all the latest gadgetry. The expedition of 1925 even included an airplane, one of the first archaeological expeditions to do so. Rice used the plane for aerial surveying, but also stocked it with bombs to drop on any jungle natives he found difficult or obstreperous. This naturally left them disinclined to look favorably on any white people who stumbled into their midst, which may explain poor Fawcett's unfortunate end. Considering that he had 3,000 workers at his disposal, Blakely's achievements were slight. A small section of road was graded and paved. A clinic and dining hall were built. Accommodation was provided, though it was mostly rough and substandard. Superior houses for American managers were sent in kit form from America, but these had been designed by architects in Michigan and showed a complete lack of understanding of jungle conditions. All were provided with heat-retaining metal roofs instead of the traditional thatch, which made them like ovens. No one at Fordlandia was ever comfortable. Blakely, having proved largely incompetent, was replaced by Einar Oxholm, a Norwegian sea captain who was described by one impartial observer as a big man with a small mind. Like Blakely, Oxholm knew nothing about botany, agronomy, the tropics, rubber, or anything else that would help him to run a large agricultural operation in the jungle. He was a better human being than Blakely, but not a more competent one, and merely extended the run of ineffectual management. During Oxholm's unhappy time there, four of his own children died from fevers. Oxholm's maid went bathing in the river one evening and emerged in wide-eyed shock with an arm missing. A caiman had bitten it off. The unfortunate woman bled to death. Morale, never good, plunged further under Oxholm. Workers were deeply disenchanted over pay and conditions and mystified by the American foods like oatmeal and jello that they were served in the dining hall. though mercifully Ford did not insist on his workers following his soybean diet. Wages were a particular sore point. Most estate employees had assumed that they would be paid $5 a day, as Ford workers in America were. Instead, they found, their pay was 35 cents a day, and from those meager wages, money was deducted for food, whether it was eaten or not. The limitations placed on personal freedom, in particular strictures against drinking, were also much resented, especially when the plantation managers could be seen enjoying cocktails on their verandas of an evening. The upshot is that the employees one night cracked and rioted, running through the camp with machetes, belaying pins, and other dangerous implements. Many of the managers had to escape by boat or flee into the jungle until things calmed down. Eventually, Ford appointed a Scottish-born manager named Archibald Johnston, who was intelligent and able and made many belated improvements. Shops and a school, better housing, and a clean water supply were all provided. He and his estate managers even managed to get 700,000 rubber trees growing, but only at the cost of keeping them constantly fumigated against insects and diseases. Even so, workers had to be sent out to pick caterpillars off the trees by hand. The costs were out of all proportion to any possible profits. At the same time, the Great Depression meant that demand and prices both slumped. Then, in the Second World War, artificial rubber was developed. In 1945, after nearly 20 years of failed efforts, Ford abruptly gave up on its Amazonian dream and essentially gave back its jungle estates to the Brazilian government. Many estate employees didn't know the Americans were pulling out until the day they departed. In an ultimate irony, the land was eventually taken over by the American company Cargill, and today produces great quantities of soybeans, the agricultural product that Henry Ford esteemed above all others. If things were going badly for Ford in Amazonia, in Detroit they were doing even worse. For years, Ford's son and heir, Edsel, had argued that the Model T should be retired and replaced with something more stylish, but his father, more or less reflexively, dismissed almost everything Edsel ever said. Indeed, Henry devoted much of his life to humiliating his son. Although he had appointed Edsel president of the company in 1919, when Edsel was just 25 years old, Henry routinely belittled his son in front of others or countermanded his orders. Once, when Edsel had a new set of coke ovens built at the River Rouge factory, Henry waited until the work was finished and then ordered them taken down. But now, with sales plummeting, Henry had to acknowledge, if not exactly admit, that the Model T had had its day. On May 26th, while the world was in the grip of Lindbergh mania, the Ford Motor Company produced what it claimed was its 15 millionth Model T. In fact, it was at least number 15,348,781, if not more. No one really knew. And immediately stopped production in order to build an entirely new car. For an indefinite period, the world's largest car manufacturer would have no new products to sell. 60,000 Ford employees in Detroit were immediately thrown out of work. Tens of thousands more at assembly plants across America and throughout the world were similarly idled. Most would be out of work for at least 6 months, many considerably longer. The shutdown was hard on Ford's long-suffering dealers as well, particularly those with city showrooms with high rents. Many never fully recovered. Work on the new car was done in the utmost secrecy. Not even the name was revealed. Many guessed that it would be called the Edison after Henry Ford's close friend and hero. Only a few within the company knew that it was to be called the Model A. Rumors abounded as to what was going on within the plant. Henry Ford was said to be living in the factory, sleeping on a camp bed in his office or in one of the workshops. He wasn't. The amount of work involved in producing a new car from scratch was daunting, to say the least. It was almost certainly the biggest industrial retooling ever undertaken anywhere, before or since. The new car would contain 5,580 separate components, nearly all of them brand new, so all had to be designed afresh. And not just the parts themselves, but also several thousand new machines to make the parts. Some of these were enormous. Two power presses stood almost three stories high and weighed 240 tons each. Remarkably, the company did almost all of the design and retooling without expert guidance, for Henry Ford hated experts and refused to employ them. As he put it in his 1924 book, My Life and Work, "I never employ an expert in full bloom. If ever I wanted to kill opposition by unfair means, I would endow the opposition with experts." Later, he added, "We have most unfortunately found it necessary to get rid of a man as soon as he thinks himself an expert, because no one ever considers himself expert if he really knows his job." In consequence, Ford had no one on the payroll with advanced engineering or design engineering skills. The company didn't even have a proving ground, but tested its cars on public highways, to the dismay of the police. Ford's chief tester, Ray Dollinger, was a man of very few words. He offered only two terse verdicts on any car. It was either damn good or no damn good. "You could never get any details from him as to what was wrong or what needed improvement," sighed one engineer. The company did have a stylish research lab, designed by Kahn, but Henry Ford refused to invest in precision instruments or other useful tools. Much of the space was given over to his experiments with soybeans and other foods. Ford's refusal to employ experts was what doomed Fordlandia, and now it threatened to doom the Model A. For years, the Model T had been criticized for having unreliable brakes. Many states were beginning to require annual safety inspections, and there were fears within Ford that Model Ts wouldn't pass the examinations. Germany was reportedly considering banning the Model T outright because of concerns over the brake safety. For that reason, Lawrence Sheldrick, Ford's top engineer, made sure new, safer brakes were designed for the new Model A. Henry Ford bitterly resented the idea of outsiders telling him how to make his products, and for some time through the summer refused on principle to let the safer brakes be incorporated into the new car, slowing progress further. As Charles E. Sorensen, a long-suffering Ford executive, later noted, no rational business person would have stopped production of the Model T without having a replacement model designed and ready to go into production. Putting the new car together on the fly, Sorensen calculated, added between $100 million and $200 million to the cost of the changeover. The additional costs of Henry Ford's intransigence were beyond computation. On July 26th, 4 days before Henry Ford's 64th birthday, General Motors declared first-half earnings of $129 million. No manufacturer had ever made that much money in 6 months before, and that was on sales made before the Ford shutdown. Now with Ford making no cars at all, his competitors had the marketplace all to themselves. How well, or even whether, Ford could recover from such an extended shutdown was a question many within the industry were beginning to ask. The rest of the world was beside itself with curiosity to know what Henry Ford would come up with as a replacement for the Model T. What the world didn't know was that many within Ford were just as curious to have that question answered themselves. Chapter 19. Before the 1920s, Florida was known for citrus fruits and turpentine, and not much else. A few rich people went there for the winter, but hardly anyone else considered the state a destination. But then the wider mass of Americans discovered the attractiveness of Florida's climate and the pleasantness of its beaches, and it suddenly became desirable. In 1925, Florida repealed income and inheritance taxes, which made it even more attractive. People swarmed into the state in huge numbers and began an intense and increasingly irrational property boom. A plot of land in Miami that had been worth $800 before the boom now sold for $150,000. Property deeds sometimes changed hands two or even three times in a day as frantic buyers tried to trade their way to ever greater wealth. Some eager buyers bought plots of land underwater on the hopeful understanding that they would soon become prized beachfront through the miracle of landfill. And in some cases, it must be said, that actually happened. The Miami Herald carried so many property ads that one Sunday edition ran to 504 pages. One of those drawn to Florida was Yankees owner Jacob Rupert. Rupert bought 10,000 acres on Tampa Bay with plans to build a resort community, modestly called Rupert Beach, on a scale to rival Coral Gables or Palm Beach. As part of the process, he moved spring training nearby to St. Petersburg in 1925. Conditions were a little rough at first. At one practice, Babe Ruth was unable to take his place in the field until a groundskeeper chased an alligator back into the swamp beyond the unfenced right field boundary. Rupert gave the development a catchy slogan, "Where every breath brings added health and every moment pleasure," and the promise that this would be the finest investment property on the Gulf Coast. In the spring of 1926, Rupert Beach was advertising home sites as being available from $5,000 at the moment. Then disaster struck. On September 18th and 19th, 1926, a massive hurricane, the first of notable proportions in 20 years, crashed into Florida, laying waste to Miami Beach and much else beyond. 415 people were killed. 18,000 were made homeless. The bottom dropped out of the property market all over Florida, even where the storm didn't hit. Carl Fisher, a businessman from Indiana who had more or less started the boom, saw his net worth fall from $500 million to less than $50,000. Also hit hard was Jacob Rupert. When the storm passed, he was left with nothing but 10,000 acres of alligators and seagulls, according to one contemporary observer. Rupert Beach was never built. In consequence of the hurricane, Rupert entered 1927 in a fiscally cautious frame of mind and with heightened respect for the unparalleled earning power of America's newest sporting infatuation, boxing. To a surprising extent, boxing was a 1920s phenomenon. Although people had been smacking each other around in rings for over 200 years, prize fighting in the 1920s acquired three things it had never had before: respectability, mass appeal, and Jack Dempsey. Together they made it a sumptuously lucrative pastime. It was this that stirred the interest of men like Jacob Rupert. The rise of modern boxing could be assigned any number of starting points, but a reasonable place to begin is with Jess Willard. Willard was a giant Kansas plowboy, and would permanently have remained so, except that a boxing promoter spotted him throwing 500-pound bales around as if they were scatter cushions, and encouraged him to take up fighting. This was in about 1910. At 6 feet 6 inches and 225 pounds, Willard was certainly built for the game. He proved to be a terrifyingly powerful puncher. In his fifth bout, against a promising young fighter named Joe Young, he hit the poor youth so hard that the blow drove a piece of Young's jaw up into his brain and killed him. Willard scythed his way through a number of opponents, then became heavyweight champion of the world by knocking out the great, but conspicuously black and recklessly outspoken, Jack Johnson in 26 rounds in Havana. Willard's victory provided a crucial, if not laudable, milestone for boxing. It gave it a white heavyweight champion, a shamefully necessary prerequisite for it to become a popular mainstream sport. Before this time, boxing was virtually the only sport in America, indeed pretty much the only activity in which blacks could compete with whites on equal terms. It is an ironic point from a modern perspective, but part of the reason boxing was considered unwholesome and insupportably raffish before about 1920 was that it wasn't racist. And a big part of converting it into a respectable entertainment in the 1920s was making sure that it was, like all other major sports, dominated by white people. No black fighter would get a crack at the heavyweight title for a generation. With only white boxers to fight, Willard began to look invincible. Then he met Jack Dempsey. Their fight, on the 4th of July 1919 in Toledo, Ohio, attracted enormous attention. Dempsey was a hot young boxer from out of the West. Willard had actually killed a man in the ring. This was a combination the public could not resist. Toledo was chosen not because it was a popular place for boxing, but because it was a legal one, and in 1919 there were not so many of those. In most places, New York State most notably, boxing was banned altogether, or so ringed around with restrictions as to make it ridiculous. Prize fights, where they were allowed at all, had to be advertised as sparring exhibitions or illustrated lectures on pugilism, with the participants sometimes described as professors. Because the matches were only exhibitions, it was forbidden for one participant to knock out another, or for a panel of judges to declare one man the winner. In consequence, prize-fighting remained a marginal sport, and fights were held in, no disrespect to Toledo intended, marginal places. Toledo didn't have a stadium sufficient to hold a crowd of 90,000, so one was built, to be used just once, then torn down. To keep gatecrashers out, Tex Rickard, the promoter, had it constructed with a single entrance and exit. Had fire broken out, the consequences would have been unimaginable, but at least they had the wisdom to ban smoking for the duration of the contest. Willard entered the fight supremely confident. Dempsey was scrawny-looking for a heavyweight, slender and wiry rather than bulgingly muscled. Willard was a full head taller and 60 pounds heavier. "This will be one of the easiest bouts I've ever had," he assured reporters, adding with a dash of bigoted loftiness that was distasteful even then, "I am better today than when I restored the championship to the white race." As a demonstration of his confidence, he demanded to be indemnified in case he killed the challenger. This proved to be something of a misjudgment. Dempsey may have been scrawny, but he was built of iron. Hitting him, it was said, was like hitting a tree. And he attacked with startling ferocity, flying at his opponents like a loosened pit bull and pummeling them with merciless intensity. He had just won 12 fights in a row, 9 with knockouts in the first round, 1 in just 14 seconds. He was an unbelievably destructive fighter, and he proved it now. Dempsey charged from his corner and smashed Willard's jaw so hard that he broke it in 13 places, then followed up with a hook that sprayed 6 of his teeth across the canvas. Dempsey floored him 7 times in the first round, then pounded away at him for 2 rounds more, cracking his cheekbone and at least 2 ribs. Dazed and disheartened, Willard failed to rise for the 4th round. For the rest of his life, Willard insisted that the tape under Dempsey's gloves had been coated with concrete. It appears that it merely felt that way. Dempsey's purse for his title fight against Willard was $27,500. Within 2 years, he would be fighting for purses of nearly $1 million, and the whole world would be his audience. Boxing had just changed forever. Damon Runyon dubbed him the Manasseh Mauler, but the name was no more than partly correct. Dempsey didn't maul, but struck with deadly, repetitious precision, and Manasseh, a small agricultural community in southern Colorado, near the New Mexico border, was his home for just the first 10 years of his life. After that, he grew up all over, in Denver and smaller towns in Colorado, Utah, and West Virginia, as his alcoholic and ne'er-do-well father drifted hazily from job to job. He was born William Harrison Dempsey. His family called him Harry, in June 1895, 4 months after Babe Ruth, into a clan that was unusually mongrel, part Cherokee, part Jewish, part Scots-Irish. Dempsey was the 9th of 13 children, and the family was poor but close, a fact that would weigh heavily on him in the summer of 1927. As a youth, he made a living by entering bars and challenging anyone in the place to fight him, for a kitty collected from the other patrons. It made him awfully tough. From there, it was only a short step to boxing for a living. He began to fight professionally in 1914, using the name Kid Blackie. Along the way, he picked up a wife, Maxine Cates, a saloon bar piano player and occasional prostitute, 15 years his senior. The marriage, not altogether surprisingly, didn't last. They separated after just a few months. She would die horribly in a fire in a brothel in Juarez, Mexico, in 1924. As a fighter, Dempsey was instinctively brutal. In the ring, he seemed to enjoy hurting other people, writes his biographer Roger Kahn. Once, in a bad mood, he knocked out every one of his sparring partners. When the writer Paul Gallico, then sports editor of the New York Daily News, accepted an assignment to spar a little with Dempsey to demonstrate what it was like to face the champ, Dempsey hit him hard enough to kill him. Gallico didn't remember a thing, but reported afterwards that he felt like a building had fallen on him. The sports writer Grantland Rice, who was present, wrote, "At the end, the head of young Mr. Gallico was attached to his body by a shred. We only hope he is not asked next to cover an electrocution." Al Jolson, in a similar spirit, took a playful swing at Dempsey for photographers, Dempsey smacked Jolson so hard it split open his chin. Yet the instant the fight was over, Dempsey would often bound forward and solicitously help to his feet the person he had just made horizontal. Although he looked every inch a villain with his prison haircut and steely gaze, in private Dempsey was a pleasant, rather shy, surprisingly thoughtful and articulate individual. Nothing about Dempsey's fight against Willard in Toledo did more to excite entrepreneurial spirits than the knowledge that Tex Rickard had spent $100,000 on a temporary arena and still made a fortune on the fight. The crowd of 90,000 was the biggest ever to attend a sporting event anywhere on the planet, and in Toledo, Ohio, for goodness sake. Boxing was clearly too lucrative to be left to marginal cities in the distant West, especially when existing venues like Yankee Stadium and the Polo Grounds stood unused for 250 days or more a year. Almost at once, New York State Senator and soon-to-be New York City Mayor Jimmy Walker shepherded a bill through the legislature making boxing fully legal in New York. Other states quickly followed. Boxing still faced a great deal of opposition in some quarters, however. Many people were horrified by its violence and brutality. Others worried that it was an incitement to gambling. The Reverend John Roach Straton saw a worrisome threat to morals in allowing members of the weaker sex to gaze upon two practically naked men battering and bruising each other and struggling in sweat and blood for mere animal mastery. In fact, as it turned out, that was very much what women wanted, and the person they most keenly wished to see glistening and lightly clad was the French boxer Georges Carpentier. He was, by universal female consent, an eyeful. Michelangelo would have fainted for joy at the beauty of his profile, wrote one smitten female observer, and her comments were echoed in ladies' magazines across the land. Women simply adored him. When Jean Tunney beat Carpentier in a later fight, a distraught blonde leapt into the ring and tried to scratch his eyes out. Carpentier was not a great fighter, and occasionally resorted to a helpful fix. This didn't always work out quite as planned. In 1922, in Paris, a Senegalese fighter known as Battling Siki agreed, for a generous consideration, to take a fall against Carpentier. Unfortunately, Siki forgot his commitment and instead knocked out the dumbfounded Frenchman in the sixth round. For Siki, it was the high point of a mostly disappointed life. He never won another important match, and in 1925 was shot dead for no apparent reason on a Manhattan street. The murderer was never caught. Carpentier landed a fight with Dempsey based almost entirely on three considerations: that he looked strong, made the ladies swoon, and was a war hero. He had been a decorated aviator in the First World War, in which capacity he became great pals with Charles Neungesser. The fight attracted unprecedented levels of public interest. Reporters came from across the world. The New York American hired George Bernard Shaw to comment. H.L. Mencken, in an essay, expressed his satisfaction that it was a fight between white men. Carpentier claimed to have developed a secret punch that would catch Dempsey by surprise. Damon Runyon suggested that he would be better off practicing taking 10-second naps, since that was mostly what he would be doing during the fight. Before the bout, Rickard beseeched Dempsey, "Don't kill the son of a bitch, Jack." Rickard wasn't concerned about Carpentier's well-being, but about what a death would do to boxing just as it was getting lucrative and respectable. "The best people in the world are here today," he said. "If you kill him, all this will be ruined. Boxing will be dead." It did not take long for Carpentier to discover how outclassed he was. Dempsey broke his nose with his first punch. Soon afterwards, Carpentier hit Dempsey in the face with the hardest punch he could throw. Dempsey barely blinked. Carpentier broke his thumb in two places. Dempsey took just four rounds to demolish the Frenchman and leave him unconscious on his back in the middle of the ring. From beginning to end, the fight lasted 27 minutes. The gate was $1,626,580, a fourfold increase from the Dempsey-Willard fight of just 2 years earlier. The problem for Dempsey now became an absence of opponents rash enough or worthy enough to climb into the ring with him. Boxing might well have lost its momentum had it not been for the timely arrival on American soil of an Argentinian giant named Luis Angel Firpo. the wild bull of the pampas, as he was extravagantly but accurately dubbed. A poor youth from Buenos Aires, Firpo arrived in America in 1922, carrying a cardboard suitcase that held one spare shirt collar, a pair of boxing trunks, and nothing else. He was not a stylish fighter. He punches like a man throwing rocks, is how one observer put it. But he was huge and powerful, and he now proceeded to club to the canvas one opponent after another. By the time he met Dempsey at the Polo Grounds in September 1923, he had won 12 fights in a row, 9 by knockout. Like Dempsey, he was a fighter who was prepared to stand in one place and slug it out. The world couldn't wait to see what Dempsey would make of him. What followed was perhaps the most exciting 4 minutes of slugging ever seen in the ring. Firpo brought a gasp to 80,000 pairs of lips by dropping Dempsey to one knee with his very first punch. Dempsey responded furiously and knocked down Firpo 7 times in the first round, but Firpo got up each time swinging. After the 7th knockdown, Firpo reached back and caught Dempsey with a right hook so ferocious that it knocked the champ through the ropes and clear out of the ring. Dempsey fell into the crowd at ringside and was pushed back by many sets of eager hands, so many that it looked like he was getting a back massage, Firpo recalled later. Among the enthusiastic pushers was Babe Ruth, beaming all over. Dempsey should have been disqualified for receiving assistance, but the referee let the fight continue. In the first minute of the next round, Dempsey hit Firpo in the head with 2 mighty blows, and Firpo slumped to the canvas, not to rise again. Most reporters declared it the most exciting fight they had ever seen. Grantland Rice thought it the most exciting fight there had ever been. And then Dempsey stopped boxing. Fights were mooted and even negotiated, but in every instance came to naught. From September 1923 to September 1926, Dempsey didn't fight at all. Instead, he settled in Los Angeles, acted in a couple of movies, had his nose fixed, married a minor movie star named Estelle Taylor, and slept with several others, and became pals with Charlie Chaplin and Douglas Fairbanks. Dempsey's brother Johnny, who nurtured dreams of being a Hollywood star himself, was in Los Angeles already, and had formed friendships of his own with several well-known figures, in particular a matinee idol named Wallace Reed, then one of the biggest box office draws in movies. Reed had the wholesome good looks of the boy every mother wants her daughter to marry, but in private life he was secretly and deeply addicted to narcotics. From Reed, Johnny Dempsey learned the dangerous pleasures of cocaine and heroin. Reed died from the cumulative effects of dissipation in 1923 at the age of just 31, but not before he had made Johnny Dempsey a hopeless addict too. The young Dempsey's drug problems and deteriorating mental state would be a prolonged and painful distraction for his brother Jack.